This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, smear a thin layer of language over the lens so everything looks a little bit nicer. Just to warn you, there's a Category B swear word towards the end of the show, but it's educational, if that helps. On with the show. In the last episode, the Rosetta Stone provided the key to Egyptian hieroglyphics by presenting them in parallel with Greek, which enabled them to be deciphered. But languages aren't designed to be deciphered. They were never meant to be incomprehensible in the first place.
Undeciphered, it's a temporary state, in my opinion. I look at it optimistically, with the general guiding rule that anything that anybody over any period of time wrote should be decipherable by somebody else.
Irving Finkel is a curator in the Middle East Department of the British Museum.
The fact is that none of the world's writing systems, apart from codes, are meant to be obscure. And this is crucial. Normal writing systems that we can't read just because we haven't deciphered them, it doesn't mean that they're indecipherable, it means that we haven't done it. And the fact that we haven't done it depends on various things. Sometimes it's a matter of extreme rarity, so there's hardly anything to go on. And sometimes it's a matter of a profusion of inscriptions which are all too short to be diagnostic.
All that remains of some languages is the ancient equivalent of a few no parking signs, or sometimes lists of names, but trying to deduce a language from those would be like trying to figure out the whole of English from a phone book. There's also the issue of the evidence being mostly whatever was written on durable materials, which skews the known vocabulary of that language towards the official and formal. Paper or leaves or skins are less likely to have survived time and climates than stone or clay or ivory or tombs. But those aren't really materials people would use for everyday jottings.
I mean, one problem is that you don't have a wide range of, if you're looking at the lexicon, what words exist in this language. You know, if you want to learn how to say happy birthday, tough, because that kind of stuff doesn't survive.
Classicist Nick Zare has spent years working on translating the language of Oscan, which for several centuries was spoken all over southern Italy, but by about 0 BC it had died out.
But we're very well up on official terminology for approving things and commissioning things, for example.
It's like if in 2,000 years' time, people went back and the only sources they had for 21st century English were council documents about planning permission and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So, and maybe some graffiti. That's another thing, actually, graffiti written on walls.
I mean, how similar is that to modern graffiti, where you wouldn't necessarily get a grammatical phrase?
Well, it's quite interesting in the sense that if all you had to go on was British graffiti, you would actually get a different lexicon. You might very well get things that are grammatical. They're not polite English, or they're not correct standard English, but you'd learn something about the way people sort of spoke on an everyday level, perhaps. But it's also very easy to get carried away with that and assume, you know, actually anything that's written down by definition is not the same as speech, and by definition isn't every day, especially in a culture where illiteracy is much greater. You know, you must have had some education to be literate.
So again, the known vocabulary is not going to reflect the whole populace and how they actually use the language. Also bear in mind that the 2,000-year-old graffiti Nick is talking about includes stuff we wouldn't necessarily think of as graffiti now. There was quite a lot of business painted on walls, like electoral posters and official notices.
But actually, in the ancient world, the equivalent of those kind of polite notice, please don't park outside here, is written on the wall as well. There's more or less no kind of public signage. There isn't a public body who goes around putting speed limit signs up and saying this is such and such road.
People have been studying Oscan for about 250 years so far, and considering they can't exactly run it through Google Translate, they've made quite good progress understanding it.
The reason we can understand Oscan fairly well is because it was related to Latin. So in the same way that Romanian and French, Spanish, Italian are all related to each other, if you found another language all of a sudden in that family, you could have a reasonably good stab at understanding quite a lot of it. But sometimes we just come across things, we go, oh, got no idea what this is.
How do you feel when you come up against an Oscan word that you cannot crack? Determined? Frustrated?
Yeah.
What sort of size of lexicon do you have in Oscan?
Well, not huge. As I say, it's really dependent on what's been preserved for us. So we're pretty good on the names of gods. The institutional vocabulary, we're quite good. Things like magistracies, that sort of thing. We know how to say to sign something or to mark it, because this is actually a really lovely find. There is quite a large sort of roof tile that's been found that has four sets of footprints on it, two left and two right, as if someone has just walked across it. And on one side, it says in Latin, the girlfriend of Herennius marked this or signed it with her foot while we were putting out the tiles. And it says more or less the same thing on the other side in Oscan. So we know the verb to, you know, walk on someone's tile and leave an imprint in the cement.
Egyptian got the Rosetta Stone. Oscan just has a tile with feet on it.
I mean, that's an interesting case because in Latin it says the girlfriend of Herennius. In Oscan it says the debt-free of Herennius. And we just don't know what this word means. It doesn't even look like a very good Oscan word. You'd expect it to have a different ending, and we don't know what it means. Is it her name? Does it mean slave girl? Does it mean girlfriend? We just don't know what it means.
Could it be a bawdy slang for girlfriend?
So, could be. I mean, it could really be anything.
This is the trouble when translating an extinct language. You can make educated guesses based on similar languages. You can study the samples of writing to find patterns that are clues to what the words might mean and how the grammar might have worked. But then you can discover something that doesn't fit in with what you thought you knew, and you're at a loss to understand it.
What really helps is when you have, like the Rosetta Stone, where you have a language that you don't know, or a writing system that you don't know, that's translated into another language that says exactly the same thing. So that's a really important feature. If you have enough of those, then that gives you a really good chance of cracking a language that you don't know.
What are the odds, though?
Well, bilingual inscriptions are not uncommon in the ancient world. You do still have to be lucky to find them. It's not rare for people to be bilingual in the ancient world. We tend to think of a situation where one nation state equals one language, which is really not true with the modern day any more than it was with the ancient.
And it's very easy in England to think that you only really need to know one language, and if you speak English and people don't understand it, you just speak louder sort of thing. You don't need to bother with other languages. And so there's a kind of common idea that knowing one language is natural. But in point of fact, it's not natural.
Monolingualism is an aberration. Most people have been multilingual.
This is the linguistic historiographer Julie Tertel Andreasen. She's been studying how and why languages vanish.
The human body and brain is quite well adapted to multilingualism. So the ideology of monolingualism is a fairly new phenomenon, only the last couple hundred years. So this whole, it's such a distortion. It is when the nation state came into being, which is sort of late 18th century political theory. Think of the language situation before the mid-18th century. There were empires. Empires were multilingual conglomerations whose borders waxed and waned with marriage and war. Nobody cared about linguistic diversity. The great threat to unity was religious diversity. When the state decided to mobilize language as a resource for creating the nation, you got the ideology of the monolingual nation state, so where we want linguistic borders to coincide with national borders. But of course they never did.
And part of the fallout of this process is that as one language dominates, the smaller, more regional languages die off.
People only give up their native language when it is in their best interest, their economic or health interest. It can be slowly over time, but usually it's a wholesale just dropping of your own native language and just acquiring the language of power. So you lose your solidarity language. It certainly has no more in-group effect for you. You can't get a job. You can't do anything. You may maintain it yourself among your friends, but you don't pass it down to your children. So it can happen in a generation, two generations.
And this is probably how Oscan got wiped out.
In the course of the first millennium, the Romans stomp all over Italy and take it over. When you get beaten up by the Romans, basically you have to sign a treaty with them, which says you will send men to fight in their armies and that you won't fight against them. The Romans don't really care what language you're speaking. But they do found colonies, Roman colonies, over Italy, and the official language there is Latin, and all the colonists are Romans, so they'll speak Latin. So basically, it's a bit like the reason English is so widespread today. There's a lot of soft power. So if you want to get on in the world, you have to be able to speak Latin. If you want to be a player in the Roman state, if you want to make money, if you want to have power, you have to speak Latin.
What gives language prestige, a long written tradition, often has something to do with religion. It's a language of government, the language of politics. That gives language a prestige, and any language with those resources is going to have a better chance of survival. I would say that's the one thing, if a language has prestige, that is almost the determiner of its fate. If it's considered prestigious, people are going to learn it. If it's considered not prestigious, people aren't going to learn it. It seems like a distinctly non-linguistic feature, but it's language is a social product. Money talks. What language does it speak?
Julie Tatel Andresen is a linguist and author. Her latest book, co-written with Philip Carter, is called Languages in the World: How History, Culture and Politics Shape Language, and all royalties from the book will go to the Endangered Language Fund, which works to preserve languages around the world. Nick Zare's book, Oscan in the Greek Alphabet, is out now, and you can find out more about the research project he's part of at greekinitaly.wordpress.com. And thanks very much to Irving Finkel and Sean Toogood and Nick Harris of the British Museum, who've been invaluable for facilitating this pair of episodes. Before I go, your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is jugulate, verb, archaic, kill by cutting the throat. Try using it in an email today. The Key Part 2 was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, with Devon Taylor, Chica Ayres, and Martin Austwick, who also did the music. Find me at Allusionist Show on Facebook and Twitter, and at theallusionist.org.